Welcome to the Student of the Game Fire Podcast with your host, Danny B. Today's guest is Brett Graham, 25 years of combination experience, Deputy Chief with Lower Paxton Township Bureau of Fire in Pennsylvania. Growing up, Brett wanted to be in law enforcement, but starting at an early age, he was able to join a local volunteer organization where he became a junior firefighter. While growing up throughout that time, he was able to secure a position in law enforcement, but it wasn't the organization he was going for. In life, there are roads that we are meant to be on, even if we don't understand it at the time. So as he was able to obtain years in the fire service, he decided that he was going to try and make it a career. Fast forward to the position Brett is in now, it's safe to say he made the right choice. Brett was able to be a part of something big that, personally, I think most areas within the country are struggling with when it comes to volunteers and being able to get rigs out the doors with proper staffing. I don't want to give the episode away, but I truly hope the listeners can tune in and listen to what happens when you realize it's not about your pride and ego when it comes to the citizens we serve. The paint scheme or name on the side of the rig means nothing to the person who's calling for help. Sometimes we must look in the mirror and ask ourselves, are we truly doing what's best for them? Brett most certainly dropped truth bombs in this episode, and I hope you all enjoy the conversation. With that, I present Brett Graham.
Morning, Danny. My name is Brett Graham, and I'm the Deputy Fire Chief for Lower Paxton Township Bureau of Fire. With 25 years of service and combination between career and volunteer. I started out in the fire service as a childhood dream. Originally had an interest in becoming in law enforcement, first generation volunteer. Just really was the kid that enjoyed fire trucks that never really grew out of it. At the time, testing for police departments was extremely competitive, unlike today. And I would always end up number two or number three on a list. Took a fire test in the middle there, and the rest is kind of history.
Okay, so aspirations of law enforcement, it didn't work the way we sometimes want things to work, but you found something else that now brings you fulfillment, correct?
Yeah, I think I would, things happen for a reason. I truly believe that, you know, we kind of end up on a path where we're meant to be. And with what I'm doing in my career today and kind of where I've progressed from, I truly think that this was a case of things happened the way they were supposed to. And, you know, I'm very grateful to be where I'm at now. From benefits to work-life balance to just, you know, everything. It is, when I look back and think about if I was in law enforcement where I would be today, I think I'm just in a much better place.
Okay. With that being said, once you figured out, hey, all right, I'm going to try this volunteer fire department thing, what was that like? Was it somebody that introduced you to it, or did you just stumble upon it?
No, so I have an uncle who is a volunteer firefighter. So he was involved in the fire department, was dating an aunt of mine at the time. They're now married, but that's how I got into the fire company, was through him. But it was kind of one of those things where I just always knew I wanted to be a junior firefighter. So at 14, I joined, and it wasn't, again, my sights were set on law enforcement. So I didn't have, you know, I wasn't, you know, I was into it. That's what I did through high school. I was the guy hung out at the fire department. I took training, did all those things, worked my way through the ranks. I was a volunteer, you know, even while I was working, I did work for a sheriff's department for a short period of time, about 5 years. But here in Pennsylvania, that's a little different than what it is in a lot of places. It's not really the county police department as some would know it to be in the country. But I was testing at other police departments and stuff. And as I was taking some training classes, it was the who ended up being my fire chief at my first career fire department, kind of encouraged me to apply. I applied, did really well, got the offer, was kind of, you know, did the whole pros and cons of things. And I took the job. And again, that's kind of where the rest of it came in. But Yeah, I've been very fortunate to run with some good, a solid volunteer fire company that really set the path for me, and in training and getting to where I needed to be. And then once I got on board, as a career firefighter, having the time to really advance my career and become a student of the craft and fine tune and kind of change my direction, and that was my focus. I really kind of moved up through the ranks fairly quickly and figured out where I wanted to be.
Okay. All right. With that being said, once you were able to get on the career side of the fire service and with a few years under your belt, was it what you thought it would be?
Yes and no. So again, it's I don't know that I knew what to expect because it wasn't something I was looking for initially. So the department that I got hired on by with was going through a lot of was going through transition from being kind of a driver combination style department to essentially fully career. They didn't really have any volunteers left. They went through a merger of multiple municipalities to create a kind of a regional department. But it was mind-blowing to me because when I started there, and until this day, it's two-person staffing. So, two people on an engine, two people on a ladder truck. When I started there, the chief at the time was retired out of PG County. So we were doing very aggressive things. We were, very policy-driven. Expected a lot. The standards were high, but our staffing didn't really match. Kind of how we were operating. So it was John Wayne time a lot, and they still operate that way. When I left there as a battalion chief, my companies, if they had three, that was a heavy day. And it's funny to say, to kind of say that now. And there's a lot of political things that continue to keep it that way. It's not for a lack of trying to add staff, but I think that just kind of leads into. We're our own worst enemy sometime in the fire service because we're really good at adapting and overcoming. And I will tell you that when I was a captain on the ladder company, I would have put myself and my normal driver operator up against anybody. Like we accomplished things as a two-man truck company that, four-man truck companies did. Now, did we do it by the book? Did we do it in the safest way possible? No, I mean, I was inside by myself doing searches. My driver was on the roof for, my driver was my OVM. We had, the wagon crews or the engine crews were, the officer would come off, run a line. The pump operator would make all the connections, get everything operating, and then follow the line to back his guy up. So like we were doing some really off the wall things that I'm sure you'll find, not just there, but in a lot of places we're doing more with less. But we did a good job. And again, if you went back and critiqued it from a fire department perspective, it's like, holy cow, I can't believe we're doing this. But from a municipal leadership end of things, they're looking at it as, well, why do I need to put three or four people on a fire truck? You guys are doing it with two. So it was challenging. And those are all lessons that I took with me in my role now to ensure that we don't end up in a position like that. I'm very steadfast in the fact that three is a minimum on apparatus. Ideally, we want four on a unit, but we'll go to three. But we're not putting two on a fire truck. It's just not safe to do so. And I don't want to put us in a position where that's acceptable, or somebody can say, you know what, that's where we could save some money by doing that. I have a really, really supportive and great, municipal leadership who, if you went and asked them today what staffing on a fire truck is, they'll tell you it's four going down, with a minimum of three. We've educated them and they understand that's the number, and we're not even having conversations about going below that.
Okay. Now, just your personal opinion, this question, because I'm kind of intrigued because I've read articles on it. I do know that Pennsylvania, it's a very large state with a lot of volunteer fire departments or fire companies, and the volunteerism, Pennsylvania is struggling, like a lot of other jurisdictions and areas in the country, but Pennsylvania is struggling. So What's one thing, if you could change, what's one thing you would do to help with that?
I think, and this is essentially when my role, so I'm the first one that this position was created in 2022. I was on board. I started in my current role in January of 23, but essentially I was brought in to bring together our three volunteer fire companies in the township to operate as a single entity under the Bureau of Fire. So they're three separate corporate organizations, but operationally we have come a long way to the point that effective tonight at midnight, we have one slate of officers that operate. We have two municipal assistant chiefs now under me. The fire chiefs and the individual fire companies become district chiefs. I had a part in vetting those officers and things like that. So we truly, while we still have three independent corporate entities, we're operating as a single unit, and it's been tremendous. And it's the data shows that it's working. We've recently incorporated full-time career staff. What I think, in my personal opinion, specifically even here in Lower Paxton Township, but in Dauphin County as a whole, right outside of the state capital here, we started too late. Just like many other things, there's a lot of pride. There's a lot of a lot of tradition in the fire service, and our volunteers, and we worked through it here, and we still deal with a little bit, is the message isn't that the volunteers have failed. The message is, well, we've just overrun our resources, right? Like, so we only have so much to give, and our department's gonna we're up against 2,000 calls this year, without EMS. That's a lot for a 100% volunteer system to handle. And up until September of this year, of 2025, we were a 100% volunteer system, aside from myself. So that's a lot of call volume to ask volunteers. We're urban density, we're 28 square miles with 55,000 people, projected to be up to 80,000 people in the next couple of years. So the call volume, has been going up 10% a year for the last number of years. It's just a lot. So what I found when I got here was, our volunteer fire companies are very prideful. They're very, very strong. And, the data they were putting out was, hey, we averaged, I'm just throwing numbers out here because I don't have it directly in front of me, but we averaged six people per response. Well, that looks really good to the elected officials. Like, hey, they're doing pretty good. I've got six people turning down per call. Well, that's not exactly the picture that is happening in reality. When I got here, I started tracking, well, how many calls are we going understaffed? How many calls are we failing? And those numbers were scary. And again, it's not that our volunteers were doing a bad job. They only have so much time to give in a day. They needed help, and they were asking for help. In fact, when we got to the point, we implemented a stipend program. Our volunteers currently, and we're always accepting applications, can make up to $1,100 in stipend a month. And even with that, we're still missing the boat. So, and that's where we ended up, we're starting to add the career staff to augment the volunteers. And, just to paint a picture right now, as I'm sitting here, I have two career staff with two volunteers and one fire station. So I got a crew of four in the firehouse. I got another two career guys sitting with two volunteers and another volunteer firehouse. So I got a crew of four, and I got another station that's got four volunteers sitting in it. So I got 12 people right now ready to roll out the door, when the bell drops. And we set benchmarks. We set, they know that the goal is a minute 30 turnout time. And I can show you the averages of those and how that's trended downward since we've put those things in place. And sometimes it's just putting the structure in place and really driving professionalism, for lack of a better term, so they know where we're going. So, instead of guys getting up when the bell goes off and walking to the bathroom to, and before walking to the rig, guys are up and they're moving with a purpose now. And some of that's just building that culture, building those expectations. But we started too late. Maybe part-time personnel or the stipend program would have worked better if we'd have started doing it 5, 10 years ago, right? So, and it probably could have been a little better of a stopgap. But I think as a whole, we're afraid to admit or share the bad news because it'll make you look bad, or it makes you, you know, look like you're failing. And they don't want the community to think that they're letting them down. So we get to the point where we're in crisis mode. And then when you have a fire at your house and the fire truck doesn't show up, or it takes 15 minutes to show up, people are going, whoa, what's going on here? And then when you start to really dissect it and look at it, well, this isn't a new problem. We just haven't addressed it. So if I, you know, I don't know that there's really any fixing the problem. Society is different than what it was, you know, when I started the fire service in 2000. You know, there's a lot of people working two jobs. There's, you know, two income families. You know, it's just people's priorities are different, and rightfully so, right? Like, and that's kind of what kills us. We have live-in programs that we have a real hard time keeping filled because, you know, I have a young member who's in college and he finishes college, so now he moves back home. Really, the college example is a bad example anymore because we have a local community college that used to be the draw for our live-in programs. Well, they're ending their fire program over there now. But even before that, through COVID and all those sorts of things, everything went to a remote classroom. Well, now they don't need to be here. They can be anywhere and take their courses. So they're not moving into the firehouses. But, you know, the ones that are still doing that, still want that, you know, they, you know, life changes. We get a girlfriend. So, you know, now we're spending more time with the girlfriend, things like that. And I applaud them. Like, they should be doing that. I've probably lost more relationships than I should have due to the firehouse. But we as the leadership still have a responsibility to ensure the mission, right? So, and I've said this 100 times, the mission is to provide a high level of service to Mrs. Smith. The mission has never been to maintain a 100% volunteer service at all cost, even if that cost is Mrs. Smith's life, right? Our goal is to provide a certain level of service, and we should be making strategic decisions based on the data. And when that level of service starts to drop, then we need to do something different.
Chief, with what, and I'm not trying to say this is all on you, but what you and whoever you have worked with, what you guys have done, I'm not saying it's unheard of. I'm sure it couldn't be easy, but I can tell you where I live, there are a lot of organizations that they were 100% volunteer, and then they were like, okay, this is not working. We're missing calls. We're getting retoned multiple times on different incidents. So what we're going to do, we go to the part-time model where a lot of your part-time staff are full-time members. When they're not at their career jobs, they're there. That worked for a little bit. And then now it's like, all right, sometimes these part-time guys are getting burnt out, or their career organization is offering overtime, which means they can make a little bit more money there. So it's like, all right, what do we do now? So a couple of them now are going the full-time route, which is good. But the only issue is a lot of these organizations aren't a part of a municipality. So they're not really getting a pension. They're getting like a 401k type thing. What I would like for you to talk about is letting, not necessarily you, but I'm sure those three organizations, they're all prideful, right? And firemen have a hard time sometimes swallowing their pride where it's like, hey, we will no longer be X municipality fire company. We will now be this. And letting them understand, like, sometimes you have to change, you have to adapt. But you know as well as I do that there are still fire departments who won't call each other for mutual aid when the fire is just like right down the street. So I would love for you to hit on how that conversation went of, hey, we realize there's an issue. What can we do to fix it? Hey, let's maybe look at consolidation.
Yeah. So I will say the one thing that we've never talked about is consolidation. And at the end of the day, and I've said this to them, I really don't care if their corporate organizations ever consolidate. I mean, you look at a lot of the big areas, I use PG because I know it. They still have individual volunteer fire companies,
right,
but they're within the system. Really, when I got here, the conversation was, and I mean, they were asking for some things, right? Like they wanted township-wide policy. Now, again, it was funny because, and we can laugh about it now because we're so far past it that we kind of look back. But it was one of those things where we wanted policy because I didn't like that company over there is not doing what we think they should be doing. So we want you to come in and create policy. And I remember even saying in my interview process, and I'm like, no, that's 100% what we're going to do. I said, but understand that when that policy happens, there might be a time when I have to come into your fire station and say, hey, you guys aren't following the rules, and you may not like it then. And that's a that has occurred. But we're consistent and we're pushing forward, And at the end of the day, pride, tradition, history, all that really does matter. And we need to continue to respect the generations that came before us and built the service that we have today. But where the fine line is we can't allow that to become a barrier to continuing to be relevant, right? So when the model no longer meets the needs of the community, we have to we have a responsibility to adapt. And we have to let history be history when it no longer fits today's reality, and then honor it by evolving, not clinging to what we used to be. So, we just ordered 3 new pumpers. They're going to be 3 identical pumpers, one for each station. When they come in, they're going to be painted. Right now, if you looked at our stuff, it's all, our main fire apparatus is owned by the municipality, but it has 3 different paint schemes. One's green and white, one's blue and white, one's red and white. They're going to come in with a new paint scheme. And that was something that we sent a survey out to the membership, to the volunteer membership, and we let them have a say in it. Quite frankly, at the end of the day, I don't really care what the fire trucks look like, but I want us to be unified. And there's some value in the fact that, some people say, well, why don't we just leave them 3 different? And we could, but I think we are at a point where we don't want to take their identity, but we need to build the new identity so that we
Right.
stop looking at things as 3 separate companies and we start looking at it as the Bureau of Fire. And that's the, we've done the organizational chart has changed. And, now like we have one command officer that's on duty for the township at a whole. And sometimes that's a volunteer. Sometimes it's me when there's a gap or, what have you. But it's one chief. So you might have, Chief 33 that's responding into a 35 district call, but he's a chief in the town. He's a district chief in the township, so like he has just as much authority as the district chief in 35 does because he's the township duty officer and things like that. We've really streamlined those things. There was conversation early on by the elected officials because of from a liability standpoint, things like that. That should we give the fire companies the money and allow them to hire people? Do we want to take on that responsibility of hiring? We did some studies and we've talked to some people that have gone through similar things, and we realized that it really is best to bring them in under the municipality because one, if the individual fire companies hire these employees, I don't necessarily have oversight unless we did some sort of an MOU. But again, when you look at labor law and things like that, you kind of run into some issues. I need to be able to move people from one station to another. So if they're an employee at station 34 and our gap's at 33, well, how do I move them over here if they're employees of it? Just that didn't work. And we knew that, moving forward, we need to push things down from the global level. And honestly, I will tell you, I really thought there was a lot of fear to this. But and a lot of effort was put into making sure we hired the right people that were going and reinforce the fact that we are a combination system. And it was said to us early on by the volunteers, like, hey, if we hire career staff, like, and I'm a volunteer chief, like, do they have to listen to me? Well, the answer is yes. And we built a system that way. We built a system that rank is rank. And that's kind of where it came from that, if, we're cleared to promote once we get X amount of people on, a lieutenant on each shift. Well, that lieutenant's the same rank as the volunteer lieutenant. Where the differentiation comes is when we're talking about administrative personnel issues, right? So the volunteer members, while they all fall under the same umbrella, are still members of that corporate organization. So if there's a discipline issue, obviously it needs to be coordinated between you know, the Bureau command staff and the district chief at that station or their administrative personnel to handle that. Really where our purview comes in is operations. So if it's anything happens on a fire scene, that falls under, you know, my chain of command. If it's something administrative, then that corporate organization handles it. But we are one, and you know, look at our gear. We've have a singular gear spec. We did everything we could to make us look like one fire department. And that's how we operate. We have one set of policies. We have one, you know, there's a policy manual that comes out of my office, and the, you know, there's an ordinance and cooperation agreements with the fire companies. So it is one system that happens to have three independent entities that are essentially contract to work under the system.
Okay. All right. When you mentioned the name of the county and the number, my head started spinning and I was like, I think I know the organizations you're talking about. So I'm a nerd. I follow a lot of fire departments. I like what they do. And so, Paxtonia.
Yep. So I have Colonial Park, Paxtonia, and Linglestown.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. Can you let the listeners pretty much hear, if you could talk about the organization a little bit, how many volunteer personnel you have, how many career staff are you looking to hire, like things like that, where they can kind of get a sense of the land.
So kind of what we've done, obviously we got here was three independent fire companies. The public safety director historically, you know, the township public safety director, who I report to, oversees the police department, and was kind of a liaison of the volunteer fire companies. Essentially, historically, we have a very, very good tax base. I'm very fortunate. And, you know, we're growing. We have a very low tax rate because of our size and our density, but we do well. And when I got here, you know, I have pretty much all brand new fire apparatus, but each station has an engine, a rescue, and a ladder truck in 28 square miles. And I'm like, wow, like, why do we have all this? Why do we have all this apparatus? And, you know, essentially it was the elected officials, who wanted to keep the volunteers happy so that they didn't have to pay for career staff. So when they came and said, hey, we need a new aeroscope, they got a new aeroscope. You know, and we're talking about some of that and not saying anything is going to go away, but you know, we're streamlining things a little bit. And that was kind of where the three new engines came into play. You know, and we were able to do that. So the structure is, you know, the public safety director, myself. And then, as we've been working through this, we determined that, hey, like these are township owned rigs, but the individual fire companies were managing them. So we had three different ways of doing maintenance and it was, you know, records were all over the place and what have you. So at the beginning of 2025, I got the approval to hire a part-time assistant chief to oversee logistics. So, and he actually came internally from the volunteer ranks. He's a career firefighter elsewhere, but so brought on Chief Esposito to manage maintenance. And we ended up doing an RFP. We got a maintenance contract through one of the local vendors. Just happens to be the Seagrave dealer in the area. We're kind of transitioning to Seagrave apparatus township-wide for logistical purposes. But we kind of got all the maintenance where we needed to be. Everything's getting PM twice a year. And, you know, everything's on a regular schedule and being handled the same way. By doing a maintenance contract, we were able to kind of reduce prices and be able to negotiate some of that stuff. So, you know, Chief Esposito is doing a great job getting that where it needs to be, trying to streamline equipment. You know, one of the big things that we have right now is we have Scott NMSA air packs in the township.
Right.
So it's kind of on the list to address, because now that we've brought career staff on, you know, they might be wearing an MSA air pack one day and a Scott air pack the next day. You know, and we actually move volunteers from firehouse to firehouse now, because all the workers' comp's the same, and with the stipend and stuff, we have some incentives to do that. And you know, just the other night, had a kid come over from one of the other firehouses, and he's like, "Hey, I'm not real familiar with the Scott pack. Can somebody go over that with me?" And it's just kind of a, you know, light bulb moment goes off in the head that like we really need to address this. So those are things that we're working on. Back in August, we actually hired a second assistant chief to oversee safety and training. So now we're starting, you know, we have a township-wide training policy that everybody's adhered to, you know, with officer qualifications and things of that nature. And that's all now managed by the assistant chief of training. So again, I'm just finding that as we grow this singular organization, it's more work than what I can handle on my own. So I can kind of function, or, you know, I can continue to hone more in on the administrative side of the business and the strategic planning and things like that, you know, driving the operations end to where that needs to be with the district chiefs and stuff, but, you know, getting those other roles in place to manage. So then, you know, we drop down to the individual companies, right? So we have Clonal Park. Clonal Park was formed in 1944. They were actually the last of the three companies to organize. You know, last year they ran 1,100 calls. It's our busiest district. In fact, the 33-5 box is our busy. Everything's done by boxes up here. I'm sure that's kind of nationwide, but you know, that area, Colonial Park by far is the busiest district. It's the most dense. We have garden apartments, you know, some old, what I call rambler style homes, but just little, you know, small footprint houses. They're actually a lot of fun, kind of quick, down and dirty. But yeah, so like a lot going on there. We have the, you know, two interstates that come up through the district, that are in close proximity to their district. Everybody's probably heard of the Progress Fire Company. That's very well. They're neighboring to the Colonial Park District. So they abut. We run a lot of mutual aid between to them. They come to us. We work pretty much hand in hand with Susquehanna Township where they're located. So we actually and Swatara Township is just below us. We, you know, I kind of refer to us as the big three, if you will, in the town. So you have Harrisburg City, Susquehanna Township, us, and Swatara. The city's a little bit of a different animal, but we have a good working relationship with everybody. And we rely on one another. But there's a lot going on at the county level to, you know, streamline standards and operating procedures and all that sort of stuff. So we kind of all are on the same page regionally. Moving forward. But so Colonial Park's, you know, the busier station for us. They, you know, they have a history of being kind of that live-in fire company. Progress is that fire company that has a, you know, done a really great job of marketing themselves over the years and getting their name out there. You know, but Colonial Park and Progress, I would call kind of sister fire companies. Like there's a lot in common there. Demographics, things like that. Paxtonia is our other company. Again, that was formed in 1937, and they broke 1,000 calls last year. So our tractor drawn aerial is, that's kind of a big draw for people coming up. We have the membership there is fairly young. So we got a lot, you know, a lot of people were developing there and a lot of talent that we need to harness and develop there. But again, they're kind of a, when we look at the stats, their first new area is probably the slowest out of our three. But they're a very busy fire company because they're going to, you know, West Hanover, municipality to our east. They run a lot there. They run into, you know, if the city of Harrisburg goes first alarm, they transfer in and cover the city and, you know, they're just kind of in a good position to support others. And then, you know, we have Linglestown, which they were organized in 1934. They're actually were the first organized fire company in Lower Paxton. And last year they ran about 850 calls and about on course to do the same. Now they're a little different. They're what I would call our community fire company still. You know, they're the only one of my three fire companies that really still has a core home response group. The other two really, because of where they're positioned and the density and the road traffic and stuff, the home response is not a real viable option. In fact, it's pretty much non-existent. Mm-hmm. So it's all station staffing, but we're really trying to, and the data is what drove this. We're trying to make sure that we also have a crew in Linglestown all the time. And again, today there's two career staff up there with two of their volunteers. And really pushing that, and then allowing that home response group to kind of get the second rig out to drive down, you know, with the building stock in that area in Lingolstown is much different than the rest of the township. You know, we have multi-million dollar homes all the way to, you know, just a normal, what you'd call an average single family home up there. So there's a lot of property value and a lot of new construction where obviously we know that reduced turnout times and reduced response times as a whole are imperative. So kind of shifting that model up there and changing the thought process with response dynamics has been huge. And it's been a challenge because, again, they have an older membership that's very community-based. Priorities are a little different. And it's not that they don't want to you know, reduce those times. It's just, you know, their focus is different. And they're very, again, that home response because they have families and things of that nature. But recruitment's also very difficult up there because we have a lot of, you know, white collar population. So you got attorneys and lawyers and, mm-hmm. yeah, same thing, attorneys and lawyers, doctors and things like that. You know, they're generally not the people that you're going to be able to recruit to the local volunteer firehouse. So, right. You know, the recruitment and retention side of things has been a struggle, you know, across the board. So that's kind of the profiles of the fire companies. Again, it's, you know, three in some ways very different fire companies, but they have done a tremendous job of really identifying the need to transition and adapt to a combination system and kind of change the way that we're doing things. I couldn't be happier with the team that I have, you know, volunteers and now the career staff to work together and build this system to something that's sustainable moving forward. Cause that's really the end of the game is, we're short timers, right? Like I'm not, naive to think that, you know, I'm going to be here forever. So it's just a matter of setting things up so that, you know, the next guy in line, the next guy to take over when I'm gone, you know, has a solid foundation to continue to build off of. And that's the key is building a service that's sustainable so that we can continue to adapt it and provide and meet the mission that we've collectively come up with and decided that's kind of where we're headed and keeping that focus. So very, very fortunate. And you know, the one of the important things, and I have conversations across the state on a weekly basis, is we have the tax base to make it happen. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's a lack of recognition in other places. I think sometimes it's just finding that financial support to make things happen. So you got to get creative.
Okay. With getting three organizations under one umbrella, in a sense, my next question to you is, if you can talk about it, testing and vetting the current officer person, like the current people that were officers, and now that you're going career, you know, it was one thing for me when I was growing up in the fire service, the fire departments that I were on held yearly elections, and so, you know, I hate to say this, but I'm going to say it because looking back at it, I think it was true. I think it was really more of a popularity contest. Who ran the most? Just because you ran the most calls doesn't mean that you're the most, you know, experienced. Because, I mean, I can say that because looking back when I was a volunteer at 20-something years old, I held the title of assistant chief of training. Did I need that? Probably not. Like, I was active. I ran a lot of calls. I lived across the street. So yes, I would always be going to calls. But looking back, I don't think I should have held that rank. I think I should have matured a little bit in age. But if you can talk about what was your process to doing mm-hmm. that? Because I think moving forward, that is awesome that, like, I hear volunteer companies, oh, you want to be an officer? Okay, you have to take this test. And then we're going to give you a scenario, not just, all right, we're going to vote. All your members write a vote. Hey, this person, hey, you're it. Yeah. Go ahead and prosper.
Yeah, so very interesting. I was one of those folks as well. So I was a volunteer fire chief at 23 years old. Okay. Looking back, I had zero business being in that role. But I was a young, dare I say, arrogant young man who thought I knew better than the guy that was in there. There were some issues that perceived issues for me. And I think that, I thought I would do a better job. And, you know, I don't say I wasn't successful, but I shouldn't have been there. I didn't have the experience. So, you know, when we talk about what makes a good officer, I don't know. I'm with you. Like, I really look at work ethic and experience together. I look at, years of experience without growth doesn't really mean a whole lot, right? Like, so you can do, if you repeat something that was said to me a long time ago, if you repeat year one 20 times, that doesn't mean that you have 20 years of experience. Mm-hmm. And again, I have a master's degree, but if I didn't apply the things that I learned, it doesn't mean a whole lot. All those things. So I will say that with our transition to a unified officer lineup, really started when we put in training standards. We rolled out and said, hey, this is what we believe minimum qualifications are for a lieutenant. This is minimum qualifications for a captain. If you want to be a chief officer, these are minimum qualifications. And then we said, listen, anybody that's currently in them ranks can maintain their current position, but you have until January, the date was January 1, 2026, mm-hmm. to get it done. So we gave people essentially a two-year window, and then we started hosting the classes that the majority of people were missing internally to give them an opportunity.
Okay.
And then that kind of morphed into, okay, now we're hiring the career staff. The questions were asked about, what does that organization chart look like? And my answer was, listen, like it was when I got here, there were two of the current district chiefs weren't the chiefs at the time. Like, we went through some transition, and one of my stations is on its third chief since I've been here. Okay. That's really difficult to drive productive change when we're changing the people that are at the table constantly. Mm-hmm. Because I saw it with one of the changes, the new chief came in with a lot of really good ideas, but he wanted to rehash some of the decisions that were already made. And it's like, no, we're moving forward. We're not looking in the rearview mirror. Here's where we are, and we'll build off of here. And again, he had good decision. Good. He's brought a lot to the table, but it's not effective for me to continue to have change in leadership. So when we made when the conversation occurred, which actually started from our volunteer ranks, that they wanted a single organization chart, I said, I'm good with it, but I want to have a say in who those people are, because I wanted there to be more of a legitimate process than just a vote. We kind of made a hybrid. So what happens is in September of an election year for the volunteer staff, they have to submit their names to my office in September. We put a panel together to interview those individuals. And then based on the training, the interviews and all that, we push back to the company and say, hey, these are the individuals that are qualified that we will accept and recognize in these positions. So you might have two people that are qualified and we feel are suited to be the district chief in that area. And then their membership gets to vote which one of them they think is a best fit. So it's kind of the best of both worlds. We get to vet them. We get to say, hey, this person is legit. They are, we believe they'd be a good leader. We think they're, going to be a good fit. And then the membership up there gets to still kind of choose who their leader is. Mm-hmm. The biggest thing, that was huge to me. And I thought that was a very good meet in the middle system. We really cut back. One of our stations had four chief officers. Now they get a district chief and assistant district chief. And then a captain and two lieutenants in each. We really cut back the number of officers because, again, we're doing things as a collective group. We don't need all of these officers. We were really top heavy. that, and we created the township level positions to kind of take some of that workload off too. But I think another big key piece to that was we put them all on a 4-year term.
Okay.
So the group that's coming in here January 1 are in until, January of what,
2030.
Yeah. So the end of 29. So now we have, unless they're removed for cause or they resign, and then there's a whole process of how to replace. We have it in a policy. But, the key was we want stability. We want to continue to work forward towards our vision that we've collectively had without having to hit the reset button every year. Everybody, really, at the end of the day, we worked through it. We got everybody at the table and we came up with what the system was going to look like. And that's kind of how we handle everything at this point. I mean, a new policy's coming out or whatever, there's a review period that goes out and all the officers get, comment on it. And we talk through it and get everybody's buy-in. And that's really what has been huge to make this work. Now, that said, there are absolutely certain things at certain times where, at the end of the day, this is where how it's going to be. This is what we need to do moving forward. But I try to be transparent. And when I do that, it's here's why. Or I might even say, look, this is a change in the way we're going to operate. This is what we're doing. And I can't really get into it right now, but understand that there's a reason for it. And it's a building block for something else. And it'll make sense 6 months down the road. I try not to, I don't like the whole, I'm the chief and we're going to do it this way because I'm the chief. That's counterproductive. I think there needs to be transparency. I think there needs to be, there's often times where, I'll walk in and say, hey, what do you guys think about this? I'm thinking about, this seems like it'd be a good idea. And I'll get somebody that's been here long, that's been in the township longer than me or whatever, or knows the system and the inner workings of mutual aid and stuff up here better than I do. And they'll be like, yeah, I don't know that that'll work. And here's why. And then I'm like, yep, you're right. I didn't think about that. And so we kind of abandon that, or, maybe we come up with a better alternative. I think, as a chief, as officers in general, we need to be open-minded and understand that we don't always have to be the smartest person in the room. We just have to get the smartest people there. And, I've worked for people who had to always be the voice of the fire department, or, if they didn't know everything that was going on, they looked at that as they weren't doing their job or they were falling short. Mm-hmm. Keeping that in mind, I don't like to be caught off guard. Like, my guys know that, like, look, if something happens that's probably going to make it to the media or probably going to make it to an elected official that might make a phone call, please let me know ahead of time. But it's not beyond me if somebody calls me and asks me a question and say, I don't have the answer for that, but I know where to get it. Can I give you a call back? Or, I'm not going to be upset that, we had a double fatal crash, not last night, the night before. I woke up, I had the page on my phone. I called the district chief that was the duty officer on my way into work and said, hey, what'd you have? Like, I'm not expecting them to call me at 2 a.m. and brief me on that, because it's just, first off, I'm sleeping. I'm probably not hearing my phone. But, I'll get briefed when it's, time to get briefed. And, that way, if I get a phone call or whatever, I know what's going on. But I trust that they're handling business. And again, that's it. We set the expectations, we set the benchmarks, and we let guys thrive, and we give them the amount of leash that they need to be successful. And that's what it's all about. We're building leaders. We're building, this isn't all about me. My assistant chiefs or even the district chiefs, like if somebody's working on a project that needs to be presented to the board of supervisors, I bring them with me and I let them do the presentation. They know the intricate details. They were working on the project. I don't need to be the face all the time. And, again, we're a team, and, we're trying to build a culture that's kind of family oriented, that involves everybody and makes everybody feel like they're part of it and not just a number. And I believe that, allowing guys to have the autonomy to do things and as long as they're working within the mission and the vision and our core values, we let them go. And it's been very successful. And, you know, again, we have some naysayers. We have people that don't like the direction we're headed. And, you know, I don't take it personal. You know, sometimes I probably let it get to me a little more than I should. But at the end of the day, we're doing great things. I think people are seeing it. People are watching. I get emails and, you know, again, we're doing something a little different. But we're also not reinventing the wheel. Like some of the ideas I've gotten from other places, like I'm not a wizard. Like this is really just taking a good idea from here and a good idea from there and putting it together and seeing where things failed maybe somewhere else and going, okay, I see why that didn't work and I tweak it. And you know, we really it's how do we make we have a problem, how do we find a solution and using our resources to make things work. Two and two has just happened to come together to make four here. And you know, sometimes it doesn't work and sometimes you got to go back to the drawing board.
Right.
So that's kind of the story of how this works, like this or how this has come about. It's not some secret potion that, you know, and when again, when people call me and say, hey, I saw you did this. Do you mind sharing? What's your email? I'll send people our entire general order manual in Word. Like, don't retype it, use ours. Like it's this works. Or, you know, I'll call somebody and say, hey, I see that. Do you mind sharing that with me? Like, we're a team here, and the goal is to leave the fire service better than we found it. And if I can be a part of helping other people, just as others have helped me, then that's the name of the game. So I, you know, I to me, it's not, there's no secret sauce. It's just, you know, staying mission focused and making sure that everything that we do results in Mrs. Smith getting a high level of service.
Love that. One thing I definitely love that you hit on is the fact that, you know, you implemented to your membership when this was going down, hey, you have until this date to meet the minimum whatever criteria. But in return, you also went, we're offering the classes that you need. It's not like, hey, this is it. Sorry about your luck. Go to a community college, whatever. Go. You brought in the resources for your members.
Yeah, I think you know, we got to set people up for success, not failure, right? Like, so at the and right now it is difficult. It's, you know, my training chief comes in here all the time and he's just shaking his head. Like, things are changing. We're constantly changing, you know, NFPA 1010 now for entry level training. And I'm scratching my head because I'm like, wait a minute. The intent here was to, you know, and this is probably controversial, but the intent is to make things easier. You know, the intent is to make it more friendly to volunteers. Well, we went from having you take an entry level course. When I took it was 88 hours. Now it's, I don't even know, I can't keep up with it, but it's a lot longer than that. But now you've got to take two pro board tests because you have to take an exterior pro board test and I got to take an interior. So I got volunteers that, you know, I got to give up a Saturday to go take a test. But now we make it that they got to give up two Saturdays to take a test. Like, we're our own worst enemy. What are we doing? And I just, you know, so if I can bring stuff in here, and that's my direction to the training chief is like, work. We're setting these benchmarks. We're making this, you know, this here's kind of the goal at the end of the day. We need to build the racetrack. We need to make it attainable. And, you know, we've had people that have gone, hey, I'm working on this. Like, I submitted this, but I haven't gotten a response from the local community college or the ATA. And we've gone, nope, you've proved that you've done the work. We're going to give you an extension. You know, we've done those things. Now, and that's a whole, to me, that is a whole different ball of wax than the guy that was told 2 years ago that, hey, this is where you have to meet and you've done nothing to bridge the gap. So if you know, these guys can show us that they're developing and they're doing this and they're doing that and they are being a productive member of the team, then we're going to make concessions and we'll, you know, we're going to work with them to get them where they need to be because that's, again, that's setting people up for success, not failure. And you know, really what we're looking for is for people that are, they're going to work hard, that are going to be dedicated, who thrive or, you know, have a thirst to learn, you know, and want to be better. Because that's what it's all about. Like, when, you know, these guys come in the firehouse, it's not just sitting in a recliner with your feet propped up watching TV all day long. It's making sure that when the bell rings and we show up, that we're prepared to fix whatever Mrs. Smith's problem is. People probably get tired of hearing me use the Mrs. Smith thing, which
it makes sense though.
Bruce-y, but like, it's just, it is the reality. That's who we're here for. And, you know, we get, again, you talk about tradition and history and all those things. And I think it's important to know why things are the way they are today and why understanding why there's school fire alarms and why, you know, the building codes and all those things that are in place. They all came from disasters. They all came from missteps, in history. So when we understand why those things happen, or we understand why those things are in place, it's easier to swallow, and it's easier to understand, like, you know, why we run certain calls that we do and things like that, and where those things come from. And it also helps us to educate the community, right? Like, I've always said, like, my goal isn't to understand, you know, it is to understand how to do things, but also why we do the things that we do. And I think once you are able to understand that side of the business, it just makes you a better fireman. Because at the end of the day, yeah, I wear a white shirt, but at the end of the day, we're all firemen at core, and we can't lose sight of that.
Right.
It's not necessarily my job to ride the fire truck anymore, but 3 nights ago, I actually bunked in and staffed because we were short.
Okay.
I can still do it. And I think the guys appreciate the fact that I will do that every once in a while, when it's necessary. Again, it's not really what I should be doing anymore. And again, to me, that's an alarm, right? If I have to bunk in and staff the firehouse, that means that I probably need to be coming into my office the next day and looking at things and planning for how to bridge that gap. But I'm also not, I enjoy doing that. The fact that, you know, I was able to hang out with the guys, sit around the kitchen table and have conversations and, you know, again, open the door for firemen to go, hey, chief, like, I have a couple questions. Do you mind? Like, and talk through, like, you know, this is why we're doing this or doing that. And just being able to muck it up and go sit and have breakfast with them and things like that, I think is important. I don't want these guys to only ever see me when I'm bitching about something or, you know, when something's not going right. And I don't want them to, you know, it's a joke. I walk in, it's something that just started recently and I laugh at it because I think it's bred out of fun. But like when they have different sounds they make when one of us walks into the firehouse. So when I walk in, the guys will go, caw-caw! And that lets everybody know the chief just walked in the firehouse. Like, but I want to be able to walk in and sit down and guys not be afraid to have a conversation. I don't like walking in the room and conversation stops. Like,
right, right.
I want them to know that, you know, just because I'm showing up doesn't mean somebody's in trouble.
Right.
And that, you know, we have that environment. So, you know, I think that's cool. And I've worked for guys that, you know, have lost touch and they don't understand and they don't stay relevant. And I, you know, you start losing credibility, and I just don't want to ever, I hope that if I ever get in that position, that somebody one tells me if I don't recognize it myself, but I hope I'm connected enough to recognize that my time's up and it's somebody else's turn to step in, because I believe the chiefs do have a timeline. You know, you kind of hit a plateau and it's time for somebody else to come in and take the organization even further. So,
okay. As far as since you guys are merging to, you know, the career staffing type model, what kind of realistic training? I know you said you have a training chief in place, but what kind of training do you allow for your members on duty and your volunteer members to get?
I mean, it's kind of an open book, really. You know, it's one of those things, you know, if I have a firefighter that wants to go take fire officer 4, it's not necessarily that we're opposed to that occurring, right? But we want people to kind of stay within their scope, or at least, you know, the next level up. Like, I would expect a firefighter to want to come take fire instructor 1 or maybe even fire officer 1 because they aspire to be a lieutenant. but we need people to, you know, but if that same firefighter came and said, hey, I want to take a firefighter survival class, which he probably should already have at that point. But, you know, I want to come, I want to get into, I want to understand the tech rescue side of things or whatever. You know, we're going to put those people on a path. And part of the goal with the training chief is to help kind of build those training plans for individuals too, right? Like, so have those conversations. What are your goals? What are your aspirations in your career? And then we kind of put them on a path to get there. We have things in house. Like, so Harrisburg Area Community College is right next door to us. So we have the luxury that, you know, we spend a good bit of time down there, you know, with their burn building, and they have a flashover box, and they have a mid-rise building, and, you know, a number of different things that are at our disposal. So guys spend a lot of time down there working on things, but, you know, I also encourage, you know, our career guys are going through a rookie process right now. You know, obviously they're on the street and a lot of self-study, but, you know, we expect them, you know, one of the things is knowing the streets and fire hydrants within a quarter mile of your firehouse. And people are going, well, why do you need them to know that? We have map books. Because when we bang out the house fire with entrapment at 3 o'clock in the morning, do you really have, like, I don't want to slow down the response by having to look up where the address, the street, and the fire hydrant is that's a block away from the firehouse. Like, we should know that well enough that we're running out, that we're able to hop on a rig and be on the street and be on the scene within moments, and handling that problem and saving a life. Now, the fire's 2 miles down the road, that officer, you know, generally, you know, a direction that you're headed. And now we have time to look up the water supply plan and that sort of stuff, because you have more time. So those are sort of the things that, you know, from a realistic standpoint that we're pushing. And this is something that was ingrained in me, by one of my mentors in the fire service, that, you know, though that stuff's important, and knowing your first due area, you know. One of the examples I always walk in and ask people, what's the address of the house across the street from the firehouse? And people look at you funny. Well, when they call out a cardiac arrest at the address across the street from the firehouse, the last thing I want you to do is jump in the fire truck, come out, make a left, and drive down the street and start looking for addresses, because you look really silly when it's the house across the street. Mm-hmm. So if you're, you know, we want people to be in tune to, you know, that basic knowledge, because I think, again, it all comes back to just providing a good level of service. And by knowing that information, you know, knowing your rig, like, I don't want to see people walking around a fire truck opening compartment doors to find something. You should know where it's at. You know, that's, you come in the morning, you do your rig check, you know, you make sure all your equipment's functioning. And, you know, then we look like rock stars and we go out the door, and that's what we're here for. And it doesn't take a whole lot of time or effort really to master that stuff. So that's, you know, when I walk into the firehouses right now, that's what our guys are doing. They're studying those things. And I show up every once in a while with a map with the street names, you know, marked out and stuff. And we work on, fluid hydraulics problems and things like that to make sure guys are good to go and know what we're doing. And again, it's all putting together the orchestra, so that when we go out the door, it all, you know, our guys are prepared, and, you know, we have forceful entry simulators and all the stations. Like, mm-hmm. There's zero reason that our guys cannot force a door. It's only because they're either being lazy, they're unmotivated, you know, or just don't give a shit if they can't, because we're giving them the tools to be successful. You know, there's gyms in all the fire stations. There's really no reason that our guys aren't in decent shape. Now, again, I got to lead by example there. I sit behind a desk most of the time now, so I'm not in the same shape I was in, you know, when I was riding a fire truck on a regular basis. But again, there's really no excuse for it other than the fact that I'm not riding a fire truck all the time, which is a very poor excuse. But we all have areas where we need to improve.
Absolutely.
But you know, it's just setting a standard, and you know, the expectation is that the guys are going to stay competent, and, you know, they're going to keep themselves, you know, and I, same with me, like, there are days where I just need to get out from behind the desk and I'll go out and drive the area just to, you know, I didn't grow up here in Lower Paxton Township, so I don't know the area, you know, even as well as the department where I came from. So I take the time, you know, at least once a week to go out and do area familiarization. And you know, I'll walk garden apartments myself and understand the sequence of the numbers and things like that. So that, you know, I'm not going to expect something out of my people that I don't myself expect. And I go, you know, and I stop in and I quiz guys because that makes me better. Like for me to go in and quiz somebody, I'm learning just as much as I'm expecting them to learn. So training is important. And I've said a long time ago, you can, one of the quickest ways to see where a department's priorities are is to look at their budget, right? So we should invest in staffing. So staffing should be a big number. We should be putting money away for capital for apparatus purchases because having the right equipment is important. And we probably should have a pretty big line item in the training category so that we can keep our folks where they need to be. I've seen departments that have very little training money, and you know it's pulling teeth to go train. Look, I know it's kind of cliche, but you know the whole saying of you know you can't train enough for a job that'll kill you, but there's truth to it. Like you know we need people to understand and recognize the environment that we're putting them in, or they're putting them, you know that they're called to go into, and you know it just we can't do enough to prepare ourselves and you know kind of be in the right mindset going out the door. So yeah, we're very open to sending people to training. And, you know, obviously there's staffing limitations and things like that, but it's,
Right.
you know, it is something we absolutely invest in.
Okay. For the future, looking down the road, are you looking to hire firefighters first, drivers first, officers first? Just trying to pick your brain on how you're trying to balance going career mode.
Yeah, so we were cleared initially for 10, and that was for daytime staffing, 7 days a week. That was at two shifts of five working what's called like a pitman schedule. They have every other weekend off. So that's where we're working now. When we ran the first list, there was some reasons, some back-end political things that, you know, we weren't able to advertise salary initially, things like that. We only got 25 applicants in our first process. Kind of working through that between people that didn't, you know, pass the test and whatever. We only got eight out of the first round. So they started back in September. So we got, after looking at numbers and things, and there were some other internal issues that kind of drove to some skewed staffing numbers. We realized it really quickly that we need 24-hour staffing. Presented all that, the budget just got approved. So we got approved for 10 additional spots for 12 to or 10 total. We still have the two additional. So we're hiring off of this current list that's open. It actually ends at midnight, or they're due tomorrow, and then we'll go into the testing phase. We're putting 12 additional on, so that'll give us 20 total. That's four shifts of five, so they'll work 24 72. So in conjunction with the volunteers, that should give us two crews. A minimum of two crews available in the township at all times.
Okay.
Once that group kind of gets established, we're going to promote a lieutenant for each shift, kind of as a street supervisor to, you know, still ride the fire truck, but a lieutenant to kind of coordinate and be the point of contact there. And then, you know, the goal from there is really to just manage. Kind of looking at the data and make the strategic decisions as to when we need to, you know, as volunteer numbers drop or where our gaps are there, continue to add additional personnel. And, you know, I'm not really naive to the fact that we're probably gonna, you know, need to hire four a year for the next X amount of years to get our staffing, you know, kind of where it needs to be, or as volunteers, you know, continue to drop. You know, and maybe we get these 20 on and we get an influx of volunteers, or the volunteers, you know, step up and we don't need to put any. Again, it all comes back to, are we hitting our benchmarks? Are we hitting our mission? You know, where does that stand? You know, another gap in our department or in our township, for us is codes enforcement. We have a community development department that really focuses on zoning. We have third party, entity that handles kind of codes, inspections, and stuff. But our township has not adopted the IFC in its entirety. Our guys are finding a lot of things when they go out into these businesses and, you know, and occupancies and things that are concerning. That, again, one more thing that kind of gets on my plate. I'm working with our codes people to address, but there's a gap there. So there's a lot of discussion about another assistant chief full-time to handle community risk reduction. There's a lot of work to be done in that department. So, but we don't want to get ahead of ourselves. There's a lot of preemptive work that needs to be done with the board to adopt the right codes and kind of build that program out. But, you know, so I'm hoping within the next year or two that that becomes a reality. There's just a lot of moving parts as we build this out.
Right.
And as this continues to grow, we identify, additional gaps that maybe we didn't think about or things that we did think about. We had a pretty comprehensive study that was finishing up as I was getting hired, that highlighted some areas we need to address. But there's always going to be things where we go, okay, like, that's not a real high priority right now. We need to get this, and staffing fire trucks is the high priority right now. So we're hiring firemen to get firemen on fire trucks, get us to a safe staffing level. Again, a minimum of 3 going out the door, optimum of 4. Then we're going to address the company officers for them. We have volunteer officers right now that, are fairly active and they're kind of filling that gap. The administrative side of dealing with, injury reports, things like that, evaluations, training behind the scenes is where those lieutenants, those career company officers working with our career firefighters will be important. Because again, the us chiefs are kind of, our focus is really on the strategic direction of the department and building this out. And it seems like, every day there's, as we kind of find more and more things that we need to address, it's less and less time that I have to be out on the street or the training chief or the logistics chief. So, it's really focusing on fire apparatus staffing and then kind of building the support system to support that. But also, long-term looking at how do we, from a community risk reduction, we've even looked at EMS, right? Like we have a third party EMS system that services the township here. Really good working relationship. They have their own centralized station in the township, and there's been conversation about maybe those ambulances would be better suited in the fire stations. Does it make sense to migrate EMS into the township model as opposed to a independent third party system? Are we able, they have a recruitment and retention problem. Is giving EMS employees municipal benefits or, a recruitment tool that could give us a better EMS service and then reduce some of the strain on the fire department? Because at some point, we'll probably have to ramp up the QRS calls. Or they're just all these strategic nuances or these strategic things that we need to look at and plan for and fit into the model or the system when it's appropriate to do so, without kind of overtaxing our current resources. So it's interesting. It's very challenging. I'll be honest, it's a side of the fire service that I didn't think I would ever, be doing. But I've grown as I've, become, I'm not a young man anymore. So my interests and what challenges me in my career have changed. And, this has been very rewarding. My mentor once said to me that, probably one of the best things as a chief officer is being able to sit back, run an incident and watch your guys, kick ass as you're watching them through the windshield. And we're there. I don't really have to even say much on the radio anymore, or our command officers don't even have to say much on the radio anymore. Our guys are coming off the fire truck. They know what their jobs are. We're very policy driven. at least the initial response. You know, everybody knows what their job is, and they come off and it looks like a well-oiled machine going to work. And, you know, our command officers, I want to say the job's easy. Obviously, they have a lot of responsibility, but we're not on the radio micromanaging what guys are doing. Like, it's happening, and it's really cool to see.
Okay. With that being said, I always like to ask the guests this last question, and it's never a question to like put yourself on a pedestal, but I firmly believe like everybody should have an end goal, should have something that they're working towards. So with that being said, where would you like to see yourself before you decide to hang it all up?
You know, I think I'm there. And I'm there a lot sooner than what I probably have a good 20 years in me yet. You know, obviously I'm on the younger side. But I like what we're doing here. And as long as I don't become irrelevant, I would like to stick this out and continue to grow this, because we have a lot to do until retirement. I think that this is going to continue. This system we're building is going to continue to evolve, maybe even outside of our municipal boundaries. Again, like I said before, I have a lot of conversations with the neighboring municipalities. You know, the department I came from was a multiple municipality department. And I think that that might be something in the future that could happen here and continue to grow. And, you know, if that happens, maybe I'm not the guy at the top anymore. Maybe I'm a, you know, number two or number three guy. And that'd be okay with me, because, this isn't about me. This is about putting the right people in the right positions. But at the end of the day, you know, I'm kind of, I don't want to say, you know, I have a plan. Obviously, I want to be successful. I want to be, I want to see whatever, you know, system or organization I'm a part of be a model for others to follow and be, you know, again, kind of something that people look at and say, you know what, that's what I aspire to be. And that's the legacy that I want to leave behind, you know, as a leader. I've had a couple people that have come to work for me that worked for me previously. And again, that's kind of a, you know, that feels good. That,
right.
Know, I've made an impact that these guys, you know, they want to continue to work for me. They want to come work for me in another department because they liked what I've done. So, you know, end goal is obviously, you know, to be the fire chief and you know, lead a successful organization of other leaders. And, you know, I hope some of these people that I'm leading now, you know, surpass me and also become successful leaders in organizations that, you know, I can, you know, obviously they have to tread their own path, but I want to be a part of, you know, and say that, you know, I helped develop that guy and look what he's turned into. That to me as a leader is the ultimate success story at the end of the day. So when retirement time comes and it's time for me to go sit on the beach somewhere for my final days and maybe drive parts for the local hardware store or something like that, the mindless job that I can look back and say, you know what, I've left a good legacy and, you know, I've helped develop the next generation to take this forward. And ultimately I've left the fire service better than I found it. So I think that's the goal for all of us. But yeah, that's, this might be my last stop and it might not be. And
okay.
You know, hopefully, what I've done here, you know, if this is, you know, if it gets to the point where I'm irrelevant here, I'm able to go and take what I've learned from here to you know, help develop another department and you know, take another place further than where it may be when I get there, but, you know, and pass it on. So that's, again, I think we're all short timers. We're all just a placeholder for the time we're there. And at some point we'll move along and hopefully, you know, we didn't digress.
Okay. And, you stated earlier before we started, you have a son. Is he looking to follow in your footsteps, or if he doesn't, is that, I'm sure that's 100% okay.
Yeah. So I have two sons. I have an 11-year-old and I have a 7-year-old. And like I said, the 11-year-old came to work with me here today. He's definitely, my mini me. And he tells people that, he's going to come work in Lower Paxton someday. So I'm hoping that that becomes a reality for him. I guess if I'm still here, I'll have to recuse myself from that process and let him stand on his own 2 feet. But, you know, hopefully I'm able to instill the same, you know, work ethic and you know, core values for the fire service in him that I believe that I have. And, you know, he'll be somebody that does get picked up because he has the right makeup and you know, is successful and able to stand on his own 2 feet. So.
Okay. Chief, I want to say thank you for coming on. I'm drawing a blank right now, and I'm sorry he's going to hear this, but I'm drawing a blank. I'm trying to remember. I talked to him because he was the one that was like, "Hey, I got a guy for you."
Justin Poole.
Yes. Sorry. Yes. Yeah. Poole, man. Thank you. He reached out and he was like, "Hey, I've listened to your podcast and I got a guy for you that you need to talk to." And he was able to make this happen. So, Mr. Poole, thank you very much, sir. I appreciate you. Appreciate anybody that has guided me in the direction of the guests to come on and talk.
He gives me a lot more credit than I probably deserve.
Well, he talked very, he sent a, he talked very highly of you. And I was like, all right, dude, send me the information if you got it. I'll make the call for sure.
I appreciate that. But yeah, he is a good kid and he is man, he is a tremendous fireman. He works hard and he is somebody that, you know, at some point I'm going to look up to him. That's man, he's doing good things.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, Chief, like I said, thank you for coming on. I appreciate you taking time out of your day to do this. Definitely dropping a lot of gems and nuggets, hopefully for others to hear, because I think this is what the future of the fire service in specific areas where you have very close municipalities where things aren't working and you and your team and your staff look to, hey, we got to make this work for, like you said, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, who really the citizens don't care what's on the name that's on the fire truck. They don't care about the color. They don't care about what manufacturer it is. They just, when they call 911, they want help. They don't care where it comes from. And I think the fact that you all were able to put that aside and go, the common goal is this for the community, because without the community, there is no public safety. That's why we exist. So I love the fact that you're able to do this. You're working towards making the organization better. And I really hope that people can find some value, because I think personally, there are a lot of areas in the country that could benefit from doing this, putting names and egos aside. I understand pride, tradition, That's what the fire service is built on. But at some point, if that's all you're relying on, you're failing your community. If your station is going understaffed and they're not responding to the incidents.
Nope, 100%. You know, it comes back to, you know, what got us here may not be what gets us where we need to go. So it's figuring out, you know, we're at a Y in the road in a lot of places, and we got to figure out, you know, we're going right or we're going left. And sometimes it takes some true grit, and it takes some hard conversations, but it has to happen. It has to happen for the sake of our community. So I appreciate you having me on. Look, I don't look at myself as somebody that, you know, is deserves to be on a podcast, but I'm glad that, glad you reached out, and I hope that, to your point, I hope there is something here that somebody can take away. I'm more than willing to share my contact information if somebody were to reach out and you know, is kind of looking for some background material as to how we did what we did. We're an open book. And that's all, you know, in the interest of making the fire service better. So,
and how would they be able to contact you via email, whatever you're comfortable sharing?
Yeah, sure. Email's probably the easiest. My email is bgraham at lowerpaxton-pa.gov.
Okay. All right. You heard it first. You heard it from the man himself. Any questions, please email. I think this, the way Lower Paxton is working, I think a lot of departments can actually benefit from this. So, Chief, like I said, I appreciate you. Thank you for taking time out of your day to do this.
Thank you.